The UK Psych Health and Safety and ISO 45003 podcast. The goal of the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast is to be your source of information on psychological injury prevention, health promotion, and best practice. In doing this, we aim to rapidly advance the global practice of psychological health and safety in workplaces and adoption of best practices from the ISO 45003 standard. We will be looking at fully integrated approaches to managing psych health and safety and well-being strategy in the workplace that meet the needs of everyone in the organisation. Your regular host will be Peter Kelly, Senior Psychologist with the UK Health and Safety Executive, and Sheila Lord of BMR Health and Wellbeing. Every week, we will have a guest episode from the fields of health and safety, human resources, psychology, and academia who are leading the way in their corner of the globe.
Hi, and welcome again to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast. My name is Sheila Lord. As always, I'm joined by my co-host Peter Kelly, and we have a fantastic guest with us this week, Dr. Jackie Wilmhurst, who is the co-founder and director of Safety in Mind. Jackie's a consultant in psychological health and safety, environmental risk, and neurodiversity. She's got a very extensive career, and rather than me reading out Jackie's resume, I'm going to hand over to Jackie to tell us, in her words, what she does, how she got started in this field, and what her current passions are today in terms of the work that she does. So, welcome to the podcast, Jackie.
Thank you, Sheila. Right, so where to start? So yeah, quite right. Now I do primarily specialise in psychological health and safety. Couple of other things I do alongside it as well. So a little bit more about that later. I've tried not to be, what do they say now, polymath. Tried to focus, but I do like to have a bit of variety. I did study psychology initially down in Swansea as an undergrad. But my first main career was actually as an officer in the British Army. And my main... I was primarily what we're learning and development and running leadership development and professional development courses for service personnel and their families. And plus I had to do operational service, which for me was back then was Northern Ireland and the Balkans. And I also trained to fly helicopters, which is kind of relevant in the sense of some of the psychology that I work with now. But yeah, really, really interesting first career. When I left the army and was looking for what my next direction would be, I went back into learning and development initially, but then I ended up finding my way into a master's and a PhD, not 100% intentionally first of all, but it worked out well, and that was very much the psychology I use now. It's the psychology of risk and resilience, how people understand risks, but also decision making, behavior change, very much related to the sort of health psychology field, but using all sorts of other relevant parts of psychology and bring them together in that context. The specific context of my research then was environmental risk, hence I still work in that field, sort of on and off still now. So that was initially natural hazards, climate change, sustainability, so understanding how we live with and act on risks in our natural environment. The bit that's the most relevant now, of course, is that when there are risks to individuals and communities, such as I worked with tornado risk, hurricane risk. It was all weather related and climate change for my PhD. And then I worked in what they call geophysical risks, basically volcanoes, earthquakes. But it was really under how do people make sense of the risk, especially when there are multiple risks in their environment and then make decisions accordingly. But also very strong element of risk communication, risk management, getting different stakeholders together who've often got very different perspectives, quite different priorities, and can really miss each other in the middle. So I did that for 6 years, but I'm much more of a practitioner at heart. So it was great to do the research. I made it as applied as I could, but I was never going to be wanting to spend the majority of my time writing and publishing papers that I was not always convinced anyone much would read. So, but whereas what I did learn from that was translating a lot of the research into practice, helping bridge that gap for people, because we all know that academic publications can be a bit impenetrable at times, some of the language they're written in. So making those accessible. So when I then left my academic career, I brought everything together to be a consultant. That was back in 2010. 11, somewhere around then. And I've been a consultant ever since. I have gone in and out of some employed roles for corporations where the focus has been on psychological health and safety. So I've worked in social media, broadcast media, but primarily a consultant since around, I think it was actually 2012. Tying in the learning and development, the leadership, the stakeholder engagement, communication, and the psychology of understanding and managing risk right down to the individual level. So that's how come those strands all came together.
Fantastic. So just picking up on that, Jackie, I know you did, you were on a kind of a podcast with Jason and Joelle a couple of weeks ago. And I just want to just touch on that social media moderation piece for our kind of listeners over in the UK that don't necessarily that won't necessarily have picked up on Jason's podcast. So can you tell us about the work that you did there and how that kind of ties in with psychological risk?
Of course. Yeah. To go back one step and how I got in there, it was actually I used to train journalists who were going to what's known as hostile environments. So the classic one would be war correspondents going to war zones. And they're obviously complete acknowledgement that that's very dangerous for them. The acknowledgement then came that there was quite a strong risk of developing, if not post-traumatic stress disorder in terms of a full clinical diagnosis, certainly becoming traumatized by the work that they do, because they're alongside a huge amount of suffering and pain, but also things happen while they're reporting, they get put in danger, journalists get hurt and killed at times. So strong acknowledgement as part of that training that they should understand the risks of trauma. And it used to be taught very much as, how do you spot the signs of already being traumatized and then we'll treat you? And I came along with my risk head on. And because of my military background, I was teaching the physical security and safety training, how to physically stay safe in these environments. But I started playing with this sort of module on trauma. It was really called PTSD awareness at the time, and said, wouldn't it be brilliant if we tried to tie that in a bit more with the way that we're training people not to get physically hurt? Why wouldn't we try and take more of a risk-based approach? So I started doing that, and that led me into the BBC for a couple of years to head up their strategy on psychological health and safety. While I was there, and the relevance to, you'll see the link with social media, more and more people were asking me what we were going to do about those journalists who would sit sort of in the newsroom basement of a new broadcast house in London, receiving all of the footage whenever anything happens. It could be from these very same incidents, when there is a conflict, when there's a natural disaster, but also day by day, not just incidents, but also just people recording everything on their phones and sending it into the BBC because they think it would make good television and they maybe want their moment. And these journalists were kind of really going under the radar a lot because they were seen as, look, you're not in danger. You're coming into the office like everybody else. You're looking at things through a screen and then you're processing it and sending it on, whether it's newsworthy or not. And it took a while for there to be an appreciation that that has its effect that we will talk about, and that it doesn't matter that they're not necessarily in any more physical danger than other people in the same office block. Processing that stuff day by day. And the clue is the fact that they're processing it to see if it's safe to put in front of viewers. So if they're doing that, then they're being exposed to something that there's a concern would not be suitable or could cause distress or trauma to the viewers. So you'll see the link that, having spent 2 years setting that up, I was then approached by social media companies who saw that background and said, could you come and have a look at doing the same for us? And of course, that is because the content moderators are the workforce that keeps our users safe. They are on the front line of making sure that all of that huge amount of stuff going on the internet day in and day out from across the entire globe in every language you can think of. None of those companies want that stuff going in front of us. When we're scrolling through our newsfeed, they don't want us seeing the things that are going to really, really ruin our day at best. Yeah. So that workforce have been busy doing that behind the scenes. And I know from my experience that a huge number of social media users, which is actually most of us at this point in time, in some form or another, I hear people saying that they don't use it and then realizing that they actually do. They maybe don't have a particular profile on a particularly well-known site. But so that workforce being recruited en masse wasn't initially given enough attention around the fact that they were keeping, you know, doing the work that they're doing to keep everybody else safe. And luckily, that has really changed in the last few years. And my take again was, don't just tell them how to spot the signs of having been hurt by the job they do and getting them essentially treatment. Actually, what we need to be doing is saying, this is all foreseeable. Therefore, you know, we know that in the nature of your work, you're having to look at things that include everything, you know, relating to animal abuse, child abuse, again, same stuff, that all those people on hand when there's an earthquake or a conflict or a terrorist attack, and that stuff gets posted. And again, I can come back to some of this. There are some ways in which that type of content can be caught early, not always by humans, but there are limits to that too. So the bottom line is there's always going to be a huge workforce. For as long as we're using social media, there will be a huge workforce looking at that stuff for us and then making sure that what arrives in front of us is usually, hopefully, and we know that doesn't work seamlessly every time, but for the most part is okay for our consumption.
So again, it's about, you know, those content moderators are there to keep us safe, but it's about making sure who's there to keep those content moderators safe.
Exactly that. Yes.
And that would, you know, again, if you take that from social media, that again would apply, wouldn't it, across all different workforces?
Yep.
Yeah, so we're talking the police and serious crimes and, you know, healthcare workers, etc.
Yeah, I've worked quite a bit with public sector as well, actually, including crime prosecution, emergency services, healthcare workers, for exactly those reasons. What I find, though, is when we do, there can be a split looking at sort of trauma over here and stress over here. But the minute I work with people, let's say, is content moderators, and we worry about the content itself, that whether they're reading accounts of child abuse or seeing pictures or videos or whatever they're seeing. And so often we find that, yes, that matters, and absolutely those are risks and we have to manage them. It comes back round to somebody saying, you know, what really ruins my day is when my team leader's not treating me right, or when I'm not getting enough breaks, or when I just feel that my targets are endlessly changing. That those same well-known stress factors are always playing in, and we've got to be really careful that we don't focus too heavily on one or the other, but allow people. The approach I take is very much one that invites people into the process to work out what their own risks are. Mm-hmm. In terms of, we know that we're each individual.
I mean, that's my own experience of working with the police in a similar capacity, you know, because we were called in a couple of years ago, in that actually, yes, the you know, child exploitation and terrorism is one side of it, and actually that's a job that they come into, and that, you know, and you do have to protect, but at the same time there are these external things that are impacting, you know, that sort of perception. And I know I was talking with some senior police officers about 5 years ago, and one of the things that was interesting was, we used to prepare officers for terrorism events once every couple of years. Now, in 2017, there was something in the some double figures in terms of potential terrorism events. And actually, there was a realization that you had to train people in a different kind of way. Because this wasn't an unexpected event. It was actually almost an expected event. And some officers might have had three or four of these, but they've turned up and potentially it was a terrorist event, or it was a potential one. And they were being dramatically impacted because we weren't really preparing people for that. So do you think preparation for these things is really, really important?
I do, yes. And actually, along those lines, I've worked quite a bit with, within the emergency services, I worked mostly with fire services, more so than the others. There is, I mean, the research support this quite well, that actually the preparation is a huge buffer. It's not just a case of how bad was what somebody's been exposed to, therefore how bad is their reaction going to be. It's very much around, well, what are all the things that actually keep them safer internally? It's the PPE, but it's that PPE is less visible when someone's got breathing apparatus or fire retardant clothing on. So that preparation is key, and examples of that would be, you know, very much echoing what Peter's just said, that firefighters to be saying, look, we never like going to multiple vehicle pileups on a motorway, we never like pulling people out of wreckages, that's never going to be a good thing to have to do, but we're trained for it, we're prepared for it, it's what we expect. And they said, we feel a huge sense of, I don't know what the right word, not pride's probably not the right word, but just satisfaction of that's what they're there to do. And if they manage to pull somebody out of a car, whatever the outcome, they did their bit, and that was their part in the whole system. You know, they'll often usually hand they do first response in terms of first aid, but handing over to an ambulance or paramedic crew. What they said impacts them the most is when there are things that they're exposed to that either they just weren't what they're expecting, but also they haven't felt equipped for them. They gave me some examples, quite harrowing, and I won't recount them all here, but just where, due to the nature of emergency services, a lot of people being pulled in different directions, and they've had to attend a scene where there's been an incident, let's say a casualty, that it's just not what they're there to do, and they're not ready for it, and they're not allowed to perform a certain amount. You know, they can do the very instant first aid, but they've had situations where they're having to tell family members that the ambulance crew is on its way, but they can't do anything further to help when they know that that person's already died. So they would come back from that kind of thing where on the surface, it hasn't been gruesome, it hasn't been graphic, it hasn't been visually sort of the sort of thing you think might give you nightmares. But they've come home feeling really hopeless because they feel like that's not what we're trained for, it's not what we're prepared for. So yes, Peter, I think that's huge. And actually, to move it over into social media, similarly, a lot of the time I'm speaking with the moderators, they say they kind of live in this, technically the word would be hypervigilance, but they live in this heightened state because there's so much of what they're looking at is mundane. You know, it is just clicking through policy that violated this policy for that reason, and trying to work quite fast, you know, is a real sort of get it in, sort it out, figure the right policy, move on. And they never quite know when they're going to click on a new piece of content because they cover, it depends, different companies do it differently, whether they have moderators working on a particular topic type or whether they have them doing everything. But for those who do everything, the idea had been, well, if they're covering every type of content, they're going to see less overall, like a lower percentage of the really nasty stuff. Whereas if they, for example, specialize in child exploitation or they specialize in animal abuse, they're going to see loads. Interestingly, when you speak to them, a lot of them will say that when they're in those more generalized setups, they're just constantly waiting for the next one that's going to trigger them. And that in itself is quite difficult for them. It has an effect on them. Because they say they know their whole day can be turned upside down at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when their guard's down and they click on that one thing. So again, Peter, the preparation, really making sure the two words I come back to over and over again from the individuals all the way to the leaders is empowering and equipping. Because whatever I look at us doing for them, it's always doing those two things, the empowering being much more around resource, attention, awareness, making sure that people feel this is important. And equipping being the really concrete ways in which you can say, look, nobody knows you like you do. You may need a bit of help to know yourself better. Not all of us have paid a lot of attention to how we work. But with the right guidance, everybody can start to recognize, you know, these are the types of things that really get me. This is how they get me. And even though sometimes I'm going to have to deal with it after it's got me, there are definitely times in which I can be more prepped, more prepared, and have all the resources on hand for how to help myself. And that looks different for different people.
I think, Jackie, with what you've described there, and, you know, we talk about emergency services, we talk about content moderators, so we can see that we can, you know, it's quite easy to, like, be able to relate to, yeah, I get that. I can get why that's a psychological risk. I can get why that would cause somebody distress or trauma. But what about businesses, just general businesses, you know, where we're locking up, we're going to the accountant's office, or we're in the solicitor's office, or we're in a factory and we're packing bags. Well, you know, I hear many people in these types of businesses in day-to-day, that's for want of a better phrase, just call it a day-to-day kind of setup, that go, well, you know, but we don't have that type of risk in our business. We don't have psychological risk in our business. Can we, do you want to talk to us about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, all businesses are full of psychological risks. But you're right. So, and this is why, again, when we look at sort of trauma over here and we call professions high risk, because we're thinking of that kind of PTSD. What if someone's doing a job in which, if you're not getting actually shot at, you might be looking at things like that through a screen. And then we look at stresses over here. And if you bring it all together and actually risk assess and say, what are all the ways in which workplaces can harm people psychologically? We know that there are plenty of risks. It doesn't mean that many of them are not manageable, if not most. But this is why I saw you looking to choose your words there, that where we talk about high risk professions. And I sometimes say that for want of a better way of saying it. In some ways, workplaces are just high risk, even before the pandemic, more so now. And I say that not to be negative about it, but just to say that classically, you know, physical health and safety has come on incredibly well in the last, you know, decade or two. It used to be that workplace injuries, accidents, fatalities were a real huge issue in some industries more than others, we know. But most people now are very, very aware of health and safety policies, the concept of having the training, having the posters, having the person heading it up. And we've been a bit slower to catch up on that way of looking at the psychological risks. And so what I mean by that is there are very well researched things at work. The key in the law, certainly in the UK, and I won't stray into trying to be a lawyer when I'm very definitely not, but I've been lucky enough to speak to some sort of top health and safety lawyers about this and sense check everything with them. But what the law is clear on is that anything that's foreseeable needs to be identified, assessed and managed. And that looks different in different workplaces for different hazards. But the kind of classic poster that we have up in workplaces for health and safety law, and interestingly, it's because I work with a lot of global companies, it's different in different parts of the world, notably the US, where a lot of companies are headquartered, for example, with social media. But what our law says that it's your employer has to decide what could harm you in your job and the precautions to stop it. It doesn't say what could physically harm you. It does just say what could harm you. And so whether you are a content moderator looking at the types of things we just mentioned, or someone going into an office where there's the potential for conflict, there's a potential for too many demands, the wrong kind of demands, uncertainty, change, all of the things we know about, that some of which have been put in the spotlight more than ever by the pandemic. I also know some people who've found they've actually thrived in different ways during the pandemic. But there's been a huge amount of spotlight put on those. And so actually all employers, in the same way that, you know, that question you put to me, that let's say on a construction site, we're going to worry a lot more about people falling off the top of a building or dropping something on someone's head. And we know that health and safety will particularly have risk assessments for those hazards. And also they're at work and they can have all the other things. Similarly, just because someone isn't looking at things that could potentially lead to what we would know as trauma, psychological trauma, whether it's PTSD, whether it's other forms of distress and trauma, you know, we still have to look at the fact that, you know, every workplace, for example, has health and safety policy for slips and trips and falls and electrical and building safety. It doesn't matter that it's so-called just an office block. There are physical hazards to be understood, different than on a construction site, different than if you're a war correspondent. And it's the same for psychological health and safety, that I feel like the foundations have been laid, because I don't want to dismiss the incredible work that's been done on mental health awareness. You know, we all have mental health, like we all have physical health. It takes hits. We can have all sorts of complex reasons why our mental health can be off kilter, long-term conditions, triggers. So we understand this for physical health and safety, that if I already have an issue with my leg and then there's a slippery floor, I may well get more hurt by that slippery floor than someone who is in really, really good health. With our mental health, there's been so much brilliant awareness around reducing stigma. Let's talk about it across different industries, things to help the different genders and what's been more stigmatized and what hasn't. We haven't yet paid enough attention to how workplaces can contribute towards harming us in the nature of our work. And that's where we come back to foreseeable, that workplaces cannot possibly be expected to cater to every one of my needs. That when I come to work, they don't know my history, they don't know everything about my home setup. There are things I can bring to work, there are things I can ask for some help with, for sure, but I need to be responsible for the whole web of what my life is. But when I do start work, I'm not expecting there to be really obviously foreseeable risks that haven't been in some way catered for, that I can go and ask and say, where have you listed the things, the hazards, where can I have a look at a risk assessment, and how are you going to train the prep that Peter talked about? How are you going to train me for the parts of my job that could, you know, you already know? And that, to come back to, a lot of the workplace trauma stuff is still based on the idea that bad things can happen, but we never quite know when or where. So I was working in Manchester when the Arena bombing happened, and actually the building I was working in was pretty much opposite. So nobody was there when the blast happened, but we were back in at 9 a.m. And that, you know, that's when you activate into critical incident support. You want to activate everything that says we really need to look after people and understand how they're reacting to this. But that's when it's not been directly foreseeable. You know, we know these terrorist attacks, I mean, to Peter's point, we know terrorist incidents are now, there's higher uncertainty than there has ever been. But when it's actually foreseeable in the nature of the work, and so to come full circle to your question, that all workplaces will have a range of psychological hazards. They're going to be relatively personal to me, what's going to trigger me and how. and what's going to really ruin my day and leave me having sleepless nights. But there are things that businesses can do to gather up those hazards and to make some sense of them. So the stress management standards are a really, really good start that says we do know that here are some areas in which we know that if they're not understood and managed well, will hurt some of the people some of the time. But individuals have to be invited into the process as well.
I was in a conference last week and we were talking about, people said about, you know, foreseeability. And I said, the moment you do a staff survey and you get your results back, it's foreseeable. Because often people say, well, you know, I'll ask, have you done a stress risk assessment? Well, I've done a staff survey. Okay. And did you act on the results of your staff survey? Well, no. Well, your staff survey is your first point of call that says it's a risk. You've got a risk, how you've managed that risk. But as you and I know, the health and safety legislation is crystal clear. Reg 3 of the management regs requires you to do a risk assessment for health and safety, not in just the physical health. It doesn't say physical health and safety. Mm-hmm. It says health and safety. Reg 5 requires you to do something about your risk assessment. And Section 2 of the Health and Safety at Work Act says quite clearly you have to protect your workers' health and safety. So, and it's interesting that, you know, there are corporate risks to psychological safety. One of the things that I've found if I go out as an inspector is I look at performance influencing factors in the accident. And these are often psychological decision-making that's occurred. And it's occurred because they've been under consequences where actually they're under pressure. The pressure's become too much. They've made an error in judgment. But actually, you have to contextualize why that error occurred. So, you know, I think the psychological safety angle is very important. And I train all of our inspectors on that area. You know, I'm part of their training course on, you know, to look at performance influencing factors, psychological safety and health, and to ask the question, when did the accident occur? How did it occur? And where did it occur? And we know that people are impacted by fatigue if you have a 12 to 15 hour sort of work period, between 9 and 12 and 15 hours, there's a dip in people's performance because psychologically, mentally, you need breaks. Your body needs a break out. So, yeah.
And I think that's hugely important.
A staff survey is actually your first point of call of information to saying we've got a risk assessment. And we're beginning to tire of the fact when you talk about psychological health, people are going, well, I've done a staff survey. Great. What did you do with it? How did you? And then it's like, well, what do you mean? And then, well, it's a survey. There's something in there. And you
tire. What are you doing with the findings? Yeah.
As I said, you wouldn't go into a building and go, there's a gas bottle and there's a processor. Did you do a staff survey on that as a risk? You know what I mean? It's not the same. It's the risk is the risk, be it physical or psychological.
Yeah, and that's why, and I do use some of the analogies from the physical because it's more, people can visualize it better. So I encounter this as well with things like, so I've got my model called the 4 P's, which helps people to kind of almost, it's like a framework that can allow people to do a bit of mapping and say, you know, where are you at with health and safety broadly, both physical and psychological? And so to give you examples, so the first P is promotion of good health. We all know that that's a good thing for workplaces to do. It's less of a kind of auditing, legal compliance issue, and moreover, all workplaces know that helping people boost their general well-being, boost their resilience, is going to make for a happier workforce, more productive workforce. The last P is provision of resources and support. And so, again, we know that we're not always in primary health all of the time. And so on the physical side, we do have first aiders, we have occupational health referrals, we have all sorts of just resources to help ourselves when get back on our feet. So the promotion of good health really important, getting back on our feet and being treated in whatever way for whatever harm has occurred. On the psychological side, things like counselling services, mental health first aiders. The middle two P's, which is where we're focusing here, is prevention of unnecessary risk, foreseeable ones that can actually be removed once you've spotted them, and just say that doesn't even need to be happening. And then there's protection from the unavoidable risks, the ones that it's the nature of the work, it's the nature of the modern workplace, it's the nature of human beings being around other human beings. We don't eliminate everything. Physical health and safety, those middle two P's are these, you know, companies have risk registers, they have posters up, they have training, you know, every onboarding I've ever done has a health and safety onboarding along with the IT and all the other things. We know that bit. With the psychological, that bit tends to just be, we've got the bookending, we've got the promotion, we're like, oh, we do resilience training, we have lots of awareness campaigns, we get everyone to talk about it, eat well, sleep well, wonderful. Oh yeah, and we've got a counselling service for when it's gone wrong. And I say, sure, great, brilliant, that's two very important parts. What about the middle two? And that's when, Peter, to your point, it's like, oh. And I find the construction site analogy kind of helpful, where, you know, if someone showed up to look at health and safety practices on a construction site and said, what do you do about keeping those workers safe who are 10 floors up? If they said, well, we do resilience building, we have webinars on and workshops on eating well and sleeping well, it's like, right, sure. But what if they got hurt from being 10 stories up? We call a doctor. We have a doctor on hand to treat the symptoms. And when you say it that way, people just kind of go, oh, you know, what about the specific PPE? What about the risk assessments? What about the high-vis vests and the hard hats and all the things that are known to help them specifically against those risks? And when you translate that into the psychological risk, you can see the light bulb moment of people going, oh, right, I see what you mean. One of the challenges I face, and I realize we're sort of talking more so to a UK audience here, but it still may well be that people are part of global companies, is depending on where the global company is headquartered, as in which region of the world, can have a really strong effect on how these things are managed. So for example, when a company is US headquarters but has globalized, they're often, the laws are different over there. So unless you take on a global standard for the whole health and safety system, in which case it does standardize it for everybody, what I've encountered a lot of times is that even when I'm in UK or I'm in Ireland, I'm in Europe, we're finding that the whole approach to psychological health and safety, which can become a buzz phrase, we do psychological health and safety, it's a rebranding of doing what everything, the bookending. And I see things like, oh, we have enhanced benefits. You know, we acknowledge that work can be tough, so we just give more access to healthcare and more access to resilience, and saying, well, overall resilience training isn't teaching someone how to manage the specific nature of their work. So those two things. And the other really important thing is that at the business level, I've just been part recently of an audit of a company specifically on psychological health and safety, like, what are your systems? And thankfully we'd been working on them, because actually it wasn't going to ever be enough to say we do resilience building and we have an EAP, an employee assistance program. If anyone isn't aware of those, they're quite reasonably widespread now, but they do have the counselling services part of the offering along with the legal and the financial support. But these posters that I refer back to that say your employer has to decide what could harm you, is that actually that means it needs to be in the risk register. Companies have risk registers, so we need to be listing the known ones. We can't expect companies to figure out, you know, what's Jackie specifically got going on that she needs us to think about as a risk for her. But it's the ones that, in the social media, that content needs to be listed in the risk register as potentially, the key word is potentially harmful. It only has to have the potential to cause harm under certain circumstances for that exposure to matter. And so similarly, people who handle chemicals, they still might have to handle them, but they do have the right training. They are prepared. They have the right gloves. What they don't get told is get it all over your hands and we will always, always give you the right first aid when you're burned. Yeah. So having those systems in place. But the other really important thing is, more so than in physical health and safety, even though it is needed there, employees have to be invited into the process. You know, have to make sense of those risks. So what companies can do is show a really strong commitment to give it clear, you know, parity would be the right word, but give it, you know, right from leaders to say, we take a risk-based approach, we list things in the company risk register, we take what's known, the health and safety executive's got absolutely loads of good resource there. We make sure all the right again, stakeholders, all the buzzwords, but health and safety have to be key in this. It can't all be HR led, and it can't be all managers desperately trying to shoulder another burden to look after the mental health of their teams. They have a key part to play. But at the business level, all those systems and processes, they don't all have to be added in from scratch. So many of the processes can be that are already in place can be just used, tuned in, you know, like risk registers, like reporting. One of the big things is communication, making sure that the people who've got really good comms expertise, me trying to do comms is never going to go as well as someone who does that as a profession. So I can get my stuff ready. Health and safety will have such good systems in place. HR often, particularly HR business partners, are right on the front line alongside teams, managers. But leaders have got to voice this. It's not just let's sit on another mental health panel and talk about when they've had an experience of burnout. That matters too, by the way. But also saying we take it seriously, that we, the acknowledgement that workplaces can be cause potential harm. I've seen on the flip side leaders just feeling far too nervous. And I do see why. Far too nervous to declare that their workplace and the work that their employees do could potentially be harmful. And therefore stayed right out of even talking about it because they felt like that was sort of keeping them safer, the reputation safer. I've seen it in the social media industry, that fear leading to saying we will not acknowledge any risk. Because as soon as we do, we feel like that puts us in the firing line rather than taking the view that I take, which is when you acknowledge the risk and take the steps to manage it, not just say we've acknowledged the risks and we have a staff survey or some good benefits, but say we've really taken this seriously. That's far, far better than to say we really don't want to acknowledge that we could possibly ever hurt anyone, because nobody wants to say that.
That's a unique anomaly, isn't it, of the psychological risk. If I walk into a factory and there's a lathe and there's no guarding on the machine, then there has to be a guarding on the machine. It's obvious because the benchmark is that you protect your workers. But when we go, and then you wouldn't turn around to me as an inspector and say, well, we're not really going to talk about that because we're not going to put anything in place because, you know. But we do on psychological health. We go, and actually I think that's in part because people have gone, well, it's mental, isn't it? And therefore, if we don't share it, and we don't really understand it. And yet, talked a number of times on here, what the pandemic has done is leveled the playing field. People are coming back to work, having experienced loneliness, isolation, a lack of support, an increase in demands, a complete lack of control, because that's what a pandemic does to you. And then they're in workplaces and going, oh, I don't quite know how to rationalize it and what to do. And we're going, well, actually, every day of for the last probably 2 years, I get a report through on mental health every day. I get articles through every day, right? So if some employer says to me, oh, I didn't think there was a problem with mental health. Well, you're either not reading or you're a hermit because you're not attached to social media. Social media has fueled some of the growth in this area, but also some of the negatives, as we know. Mm-hmm. I spoke with Sheila yesterday and talked to Tim Marsh and Stephen Taylor wrote a book on the psychology of pandemic, and he talks about how you fuel a conspiracy theories and actually that it's a powerful, you can almost track psychologically people's adaption to extreme situations, which we've known anyway through the many early studies that were done. But the difference now being is actually at the forefront of this pandemic is that the influenza will be conquered. It will disappear. The recession will disappear. But we won't on our mental health. Our mental health is the backstory to the pandemic. That's what's going to be impacted.
And I think that has highlighted as much as ever the point of the kind of the partnership, the relationship between businesses and employees. I think it's brought it into sharp focus, actually, as you said, Peter, because I've seen this, it's a difficult balance, but the pendulum swing where, for example, I've seen businesses take on too much responsibility for people's mental health. And what I mean by that is really feeling the need to pick up all of the time, every employee, and whether they're doing okay or not, have every resource available. And I sometimes had to pull businesses gently back and say, you aren't actually a full health service. You are a responsible employer. Help your managers not to overstretch. Help your managers not be telling their teammates that they can text them at 2 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes that might be required, but signposting, all of those things that allow a business to say, where do you start and end as a business with what your responsibility is? However, I have also seen businesses want to almost, you know, ad infinitum, make their workforce more resilient. If we just give them more resilience training and more, you know, more comms around the EAP and how it's all there for them to cope, we can keep on ignoring the fact that maybe demands are too high, uncertainty is too great, there's not enough control, the loneliness.
Yeah, so where did resilience hit, Jackie, in the pandemic?
Yeah. And I think that's why what we're looking at here is saying how that balance between businesses doing what, because we're talking health and safety, we talk of duties of care, like, we know businesses have a duty of care. What does it actually look like? So whether it's risk registers, consultation processes, that surveys have their place, they are brilliant. You can do these pulse surveys that do much more of a quick temperature check as you go. They all are part of the puzzle, but just good old consultation. And when I say consultation, you can have focus groups, channels. You can also just have a really good culture. I'll give you the example of content moderation, where teams know, and I've seen this work well, that let's say they cover a particular language, a particular part of the world, that they can flag up early and say, we're seeing a high volume of a certain type of content at the moment. It happened in South America. There was a load of stuff around torture. And they spoke up early, generally. It wasn't any individual was saying, I've been hurt now. They were saying, we're concerned because we felt this exposure go up. That is much more of a health and safety kind of reporting channel. It's not all on the individual. You're struggling. We'll get you some reasonable adjustments, which is also, as I say, also got its place. But this is a workplace risk being reported at the right moment up through, whether it's HR, business partners, managers. And it would get to us with very close involvement from health and safety. And we could look at saying, what do we do right now to boost the protective nature? How do we equip you? How do we prepare you for this temporary higher volume of a type of content? But that can happen through periods of change and uncertainty, periods of loneliness, where the culture of speaking up is a genuine one. It's not posters that tell you that speaking up, it's that those things will be received. But bringing the employees in is the bit where, again, duties of care, when I've been running training around this, is it can get missed out that employees have their own duty of care. We can get a little overprotective. For all that we've been underprotective in some ways, like with content moderators, we can be overprotective about feeling that we've got to, particularly managers, line managers, feeling they're supposed to spot endless lists of clinical symptoms and they're getting trained to look for them. When the bottom line is someone their normal selves? And you really need to know what their normal selves is to know when they're not their normal selves. Hence, during a pandemic, how do we keep checking what someone's character is like? Make sure that they are known as an individual. If they start becoming very different than that, check it out. That's more important than knowing that you've got to look for a list of clinical symptoms. But the other bit is the individual duty of care, that when I sign a contract, whether it's employed, consultant or anything else, I've got to keep my own health and well-being as a baseline responsibility. I need to understand myself well enough to know which types of conditions do not, the older I get, the more I know. I then spent a good long while ignoring them even when I did know. So my duty of care is to say there are certain contexts, certain triggers, certain things that when I know myself well, I know that those are the ones that will hit me, potentially cause me harm. I want to be able to speak up about them and I want to be able to have access to the right resources, but I've got to know some of what that is. I have to be able to understand and say, you know, before it gets too bad, before I reach a real point where I'm not functioning well anymore, how can I enter into this relationship, whether it's with a manager, whoever it might be, and just say, it doesn't have to be, I now need counselling or I now need help for harm that's been done. It could just be, I'm going into a phase. We did, for example, we did this with journalists to get them to, you have a lot of freelance journalists coming in and out of the business. They could be hired as a camera operator for a documentary and then only find out quite a long way through the planning that the documentary is on child sexual abuse and they're going to be filming interviews with perpetrators, for example. That there's a chance really early on for them to say, gosh, I think I'd find that really, really triggering. That's health and safety. So therefore, how do we manage those risks? Or even at the most extreme to say, this isn't the assignment for me.
Yeah,
I've realized that's going to be too difficult for me.
Yeah. So it's
I just want to pick up on a few things that you've said there, Jackie. So, you know, a lot of what you said, well, everything you've said is music to my ears. You know, we definitely, you know, agree on all of that stuff. And, you know, you talked about the shared responsibility there for employers and employees. You know, you talked about the bookends of having, you know, at the moment we've got the health promotion stuff, not a legal requirement. We've got the MHFA, we've got the EAP, not a legal requirement. We haven't got the risk assessment, legal requirement. Okay. And then we've got, as you said before, you know, we've got certain business leaders that just don't want to put the head above the parapet. And, you know, we had a barrister on, you know, a while back, a very well-respected barrister, Gerard Fallin, a big health and safety barrister. And, you know, he was saying that standards even like 45001 are now being used more and referred to more in courts of law to ask business leaders if they find themselves in that position. You know, what have you done in terms of meeting your duty of care as an employer? Because by simply hiding your head in the sand and going, didn't really know about that piece of legislation, so I decided, you know, we didn't do it. I didn't know is not defensible in law. So,
yeah.
You know, and I think for me that, you know, now we've, you know, this pandemic, although it's given us a lot of trauma, has also given us a lot of opportunity.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, as you said, there's been so much work done on awareness, but now we need to take it to that next step. We know what makes us ill. We know what those signs and symptoms are of being ill. But actually, wouldn't it make sense now to help us to stop that? The reason I'm kind of recapping on all of this is that I want to bring it back or bring in now ISO 45003.
Yeah.
And the standard, because I think that, well, you know, the timing of the standard, the content of the standard, what the standard's there to do. And you touched before about having international standards because of the different kind of cultural and regional differences, is to really pick up on your thoughts on the standard, its potential to create change and momentum and clarity around what businesses need to do. Because many, many businesses are familiar with an ISO framework, aren't they?
Yes. So, yeah, thank you for bringing that round, because I think there we go. I have my coffee too. I've been delighted by this standard, would be the first thing to say. Just to pick up again on that lawyer, the talking to the barrister, because I was coming at this as a research background in risk, I guess I came in sort of logically years ago saying, why wouldn't we try and do it like this? And I realised there are loads of reasons why not. The other thing, when I spoke to lawyers in the early days, just to check I wasn't going completely crazy with this sort of idea of the four P's and saying, why aren't we doing these bits for the psychological? One of the things that got said to me back then was more around the trauma related, because I'm aware that there's, you know, the stress management standards, there's been a lot of work on what I would call the kind of pressure related, more general. I don't want to diminish them because they are really, really, you know, can have severe effects. But the trauma related risks, like say, like journalists going to war zones, when I spoke with lawyers early on, they said, if a journalist came forward and said, I believe I've been harmed by the work I do, it's psychological harm, whether you're going to get a clinical diagnosis of PTSD or not, what the law says is harm. I've been harmed. So whatever kind of harm that might be, health harm, you know, injury, illness, employers would have had a very strong case up until almost now. Because despite the fact the law is very clear, and the law always said what the law says, which is you have to look at any potential harm, there wasn't the guidance in place to take a risk-based approach. And so when I did speak to lawyers, they said, actually, even where there has potentially been psychological harm, and yes, it could logically be seen as foreseeable, where are employers going to go to get the right kind of guidance, the right resources for the whole host of types of sort of hazards and risks? What ISO 45003 does is bring in a brilliant framework for that, because what's been said, whenever I've gone in for several years now and taken that four P's, taken the construction site analogy, talked about the bookends, I don't think I've encountered anyone from chief exec level to frontline worker that hasn't just gone, oh yeah, that, I mean, no one's argued. The next step though has just been, but that surely that's not possible. Surely it isn't possible to do this for psychological risks, because they are just so intangible and they're so much more personal. And how are we supposed to figure it out? And I don't claim to have all the answers for that, far from it. What I have got is a lot of experience of seeing where do those relationships meet, whereby what can a business do to go as far as is reasonably possible with identifying risks that could foreseeably affect enough people to be in a risk register. With, and then when you do a risk assessment, you don't know exactly what impact you'll have on every single employee, but you can say broadly, we know that viewing a particular type of content can have these effects if unmanaged. Therefore, we now know that the control measures would be based on really good research that can reduce the chances of harm from that. You can go, businesses can go a certain distance with that, but then we'll be relieved to know that there is a point at which their duty of care is completely reasonable, to have the systems in place, to have the resources, to use the research available. And then the employee has to come into the process, be invited in. Yes, have the right culture, lots of work on safety culture to incorporate the psychological, but have to be responsible for understanding their own risk management plan. So I work a lot with individual employees to say, what does your risk management plan look like so that you can enter into the systems, your workplace. So where 45,003 comes in for me is it really helps to structure and identify the roles, I think, of leaders, because we can talk about duties of care, but everyone's is different. You know, leaders is very much more around endorsing and engaging and speaking. I've seen a lot of leaders be great at talking about mental health awareness, but I said that earlier, not so quick to agree that their own workplace could ever be potentially harmful. When we now know in physical, we know that businesses who declare risks and manage them are seen far more favorably on the physical risk side than those who just don't. So how do we get there? And leaders can speak up, they can be very visible, they can really promote that culture. And then there are, you know, health and safety have their role. And I think, again, the standard really helps to fine tune that and say, how do we capture things that are, what goes on inside our minds is a bit inaccessible at times, but actually, how can we capture it in a way that's structured, that it allows each person to understand their role better? What does health and safety need to do? What does HR need to do? What do managers need to do? What do individual employees need to do? And then structuring the kinds of hazards and saying, here's a really good idea of the types of things that are known within workplaces, and also the things that are not by omission. Not that I think that, you know, the standard, of course, will continue to evolve, but I do think it allows that structure. And as I said, I got the earlier draft ahead of it so that I could see, and I was so relieved to see that it was very, there were things in there I hadn't thought of. There were things I've thought of that I don't think are fully in there, partly to do with the industries. But what I looked at and thought, thank goodness, this is really making sense for the work.
It was, Jackie, it was a hard graft.
I imagine. Yeah, I've been really looking forward to it.
The interesting thing for us in the development, and as we went through the standing up, when we sort of developed, we went the context of the organisation, the leadership and participation, what does that mean? You know, organisational roles, responsibilities, planning, your general responses to the risks and the hazards that were there, hazard identification, support, what resources? This is where we're talking now about the support element, and then the operation, how do you eliminate the risk? And you know, it's a can-do act response to the situation. And hopefully you'll have seen that within it is, although hierarchy control is 45,001's primary motivation in tackling risk, you know, they use that. You'll have seen, we made sure that primary, secondary, and tertiary for psychological health, safety, and well-being is in there, because actually it is part of that process. As you know, it's not a defined standard. You know, in terms of regulatory perspective, you know, it maybe doesn't have the same clarity. But what I have been telling people is, if I was to ask as an inspector, have you done a risk assessment, and do you have a management system to protect your people's psychological health, then this would be a long way into what I need for me to go.
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
But yeah, it's, wait and see it. I mean, maybe in the next few years we could find ourselves in a situation where we're all called back to the room for another.
I mean, I think at the moment it completely, not only does it highlight all of the players, I don't have to keep using the stakeholder, the people, all of the people who we know have a really, really key role to play, which at one level is everybody, let's be clear, it's absolutely everybody. But I know there's been sometimes I've talked to health and safety who felt quite panicked that they're meant to be taking on what would really be an HR role. I've seen HR panic that they're supposed to understand health and safety. I've seen leaders, etc. You know, it kind of all comes into the mix. What I think the standard does brilliantly is help to reassure. So yes, there's a lot of work to do, but I do think it helps to clarify and reassure for people to say, look, if you're a health and safety practitioner, you don't need at the moment to understand all of the ins and outs of psychological conditions and harm. You need to keep knowing what you know, which is that you have systems and processes and structures where people can report concerns. You can have a risk register. You can bring in the right professionals to look at how you meaningfully a risk assess psychological harm, because probably most health and safety people are not trained for that. But you know, it took a while to get, you know, we now know that hazardous, there are specialist areas within health and safety already, you know, hazardous materials, working from height, etc., where the right specialists come in at the right time to populate risk assessments with the right content. So nobody needs to specialize in all of it, but the processes, most companies have got really good processes. I'm sure they can keep being improved, but that's why, again, I've seen a company again that's headquartered somewhere completely else that doesn't understand or doesn't have the same health and safety standards that we would know. And using the ISO 45001 has been amazing across a global company that's growing rapidly to be able to get everyone to come in and say, don't get hung up on what the law in Singapore says versus China versus the US versus Brazil. Just look at this standard, and then 45003 slots in beautifully. So I think it's an incredible step. And I think the more that people start working with the standard, the more sense that will make about how it comes to life in each industry or each organization.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're hearing that some one or two South American countries have adopted it into law now.
Fantastic.
We're a long way off from that in Europe. But yeah, I think, I mean, it's good to hear that, because obviously we're, I was wrapped up in it for 3 years, so and even just spending a day on the word risk and a day, mm-hmm. is that kind of, these are the tightness and the levels of discussions that you have. It certainly does reframe your mind as to what you think are priorities for an organization to manage it. And I've said this consistently for the last 6 to 12 months. This is not a new emerging threat, but it is the seminal threat to people's occupational health is mental illness at mm-hmm. work. And we've got to differentiate between mental health, which is actually what we're trying to do to create workplaces that increase people's sense of well-being and actually help them to work, to actually the outcome is mental illness. Depression and anxiety is an outcome of poorly managed work, can be an outcome of poorly managed work.
And that's where I think that, to put it back into the big mental health context, is that, you know, if I'm going to take on an employment contract, I want to feel that I'm that's a different kind of psychological safety, the more what Google did around, I want to feel that I can say, you know, I do have a history of X or an issue with Y. That links to neurodiversity, actually, and why I do a lot of work around that, to say I'm the way I am. I only ever expect to be met halfway. I don't expect to be catered for in every bit of my uniqueness. But what I expect is that I know my life outside of work. I know my history. I know my context. I want to be able to take whatever is appropriate into work and just say, these are the things I could use a bit of support in at times, or this is me. And that feel that I'll be well received, and that I will have access to the right resources at the right time, whether it's reasonable adjustments, occupational health referrals, the EAP. At the same time, I also want to know that when I start this new piece of work, I'm not going to have a load more things added on that I'm just supposed to manage myself. I want to see that they say, oh, we know the nature of your work poses these potential challenges to you. You know, we can use language that sometimes is a little bit better. We don't have to talk about hazards all the time. We could talk about challenges, impacts, solutions. Mm. I think it's helpful to use some of the health and safety language just to get it to go, oh, that light bulb moment of thing, these are hazards that need to be risk assessed, that have to have control measures. But there are ways in which we can help everyone make sense of what that actually means. So thank you for your hard work, Peter, because I don't think there could be a better time for this, actually.
What's really interesting is under the context of organization, general sets 4.1.1d, adjusts the design of activities to manage psychosocial risk to suit the specific context of the workplace, is what you just exactly said. It's the simplicity of understanding where the risk sits in that organization and what it's doing. And remembering also, we're talking about hazards here. They only become risks when they're not managed.
Right. Yeah. And that's where, I want to encourage when I have worked with those, I completely get it that, I've worked with HR people do feel like, but I'm not a health and safety professional. And I can't risk assess. I don't understand. Or I might have health and safety people saying we don't do mental health because they think it's the first P and the last P. It's like, this is what we thought, that mental health was all to do with health promotion and then treating problems and having mental health first aid. So just helping everyone reframe to the point to say, no, nobody needs to become overnight experts in an entire new field. What everyone wants to do is bring to the table what they already know, because it's actually what's needed. And then you can see where the gaps are. Like, we do need someone to help us make sense of how to meaningfully risk assess things that are psychological in nature. That's where colleagues of mine, myself, we come in with our different expertise, clinical, counselling, risk. But actually, first and foremost, businesses usually have loads of stuff in place that can be used with a minimal amount of extra work, the systems and the processes. So often it is getting the right people talking and realizing that they don't initially quite speak the same language. I've been in meetings with HR and health and safety where they can miss each other a few times, but then they sort of realize that actually so much of what's needed is there. It is a lot of communication, of changes in perspective. Getting the right expertise in to do what Pete's just said, is look at the context of that business and say, we don't need to worry about a whole bunch of things that we've heard about on social media or read in a standard. If it's not specific to our business, the size of our business, the geographical reach, and the nature of the work that we do.
Well, what you're doing is just assessing the potential of the hazard to create the risk. And if it's really high, do something about it. That's the whole principle of risk assessment.
Exactly. And not to be scared of the word risk. The whole point is, if you've declared risks, you're going to be able to manage them.
Yes. We've gone way over, haven't we?
Yeah.
Way over. But I could talk to Jackie for absolutely hours.
we might have to do an hour on this one.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I just think, I think sometimes organisations, we overthink this stuff. As you say, we've got the frameworks, we've got it all in place. All we're doing is factoring. If we came and said, we've just brought a new job and actually there are these slip, trips and falls, additional hazards that need to go into play, they'd just be pulled into the system and they'd be dealt with. And we need to say, workload autonomy, role clarity, by the way, here's another bunch of hazards, pull them into the system in exactly the same way. And I think sometimes, I think a lot of the work that's been done over the last few years in terms of building awareness of mental health and all that, it's fantastic. But I also think it's created this air of mystery around it, that you have to have these superpowers to actually be able to address them. And I think in some respects, some of that does more harm than good. But I think now, as the standard evolves and we start to bring it into everyday business language, people will be able to understand it better. And adopt it.
I think, me and Jackie I want organizational resiliency. Yeah. And I'm well known for not answering this, that coming along. I won't do talks on individual resilience and mindfulness. I will do talks on organizational mindfulness and organizational resilience, because for me, you can do the first two, you can do it at an individual level, but unless the systems and processes in place are there to support the people, if you are not a resilient organization and you're not applying the same principles of resilience to the organization, then you're creating expectation and not delivering. We've had that before. We've seen that with people going, well, I put people on resilience training, they come back and they don't like the job.
Yeah, and that's why I do the individual training I do, and there's a version for line managers as well. It's called MAPS. It's actually managing psychological safety, but MAPS, because it's actually mapping out where, instead of the general resilience, it's saying your business has done all of these things to understand what could potentially harm you, as far as they're able to know in terms of the context of work. not getting your personal circumstances, but putting channels in place that you can say if there is something. But this is what your organization's done. These are the systems and processes you can access. Now, how do we help you have your own risk management plan for the aspect of your work and your workplace that personally challenge you? And it takes them on a bit of a journey where they don't get to just be told, you're a content moderator, so you must be disturbed by this. They get to figure out what aspect of the role that you do actually, is it the target meeting? Is it the policy changes? Is it the uncertainty? Is it the working from home? Is it reading about, you know, child exploitation? What actually is it? And then not just could it hurt you, could it not? It's then how is it that it affects you? And therefore, what are your own personal resources to help you with that in a much more proactive way? And then also, how do you tap into what the organization is providing you? Hence it, the meet in the middle part, the individual employees, again, I use the words equip and empower, that an individual employee comes away just going, my organization takes this seriously. They've done as much work as they can. And now I've got a system I can enter into, because I now know that on that day when, or not even on that day where I'm triggered by something, even just going to a manager and saying, there's a particular type of thing that I know is really bothering me, and I've got an idea how I could deal better with it. And that personal risk management comes and meets the organization, and that all the right resources are there and they're accessible. Again, I've seen organizations where EAPs just, it's an email that keeps going around, and we all know what inboxes look like. They get lost. And just finding out, like, how is it that you actually, it comes back, I said earlier on, really good comms people who can do fabulous ways of, when you were physically in work, posters on the good old posters on the back of the loo door next to the coffee machine, and just net peer support. We've talked for far too long already, but peer support networks, being really genuinely resourced and equipped, because I feel that there is so much that we can all do for each other as caring peers. But that said, so we're not trying to be therapists, we're not trying to be counsellors, we're not trying to be health professionals, but companies can do a lot to offer skills to peer support networks that are really practical skills, how to listen well, how to have the right boundaries, how to signpost well, and that actually we can, again, it's another thing businesses can invest in, is to have your own workforce be a huge plus towards looking after each other, beyond just being kind and compassionate, but having tangible skills you can come away with. I think that's what plays into organizational resilience.
Yeah.
That your workforce becomes a resilient part of the company.
Yeah. I think what you've described there as well, for me, that, you know, with me, that resonates as workforces allowing their workers to be human.
Yeah.
Leave the human piece at the front door, because all of a sudden we've walked through the door and we're supposed to be something different now.
So, Jeff, you were just going to explain something. What was that?
The standard for me has got multiple benefits, some of which we've really talked about around the structure and turning things from a scary unknown into a much more clear structured known about who can do what. I think the other thing that's really important about it is that the laws always said what the laws said. We know that employers do have a legal duty to identify anything that could cause harm. It doesn't specify that it's only physical. But in the past, the lack of really good, solid, tangible guidance has meant that companies have slightly been able to just sit tight and do lots of great mental health awareness, do the bookending I talked about. And it's kind of felt like enough. We talk about mental health. We talk about mental health, and we have great awareness campaigns, and that's wonderful. What this standard does is put the onus right there that says there's a standard to follow now, actually. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you're not going to follow it, it's going to be a lot harder, to be quite honest, to say, well, we didn't really understand how to do this right, because we can talk about stress management standards and stress management and resilience. And Peter, you've talked about why we don't do individual resilience. So I think what the standard also does is it does kind of just really encourage that duty of care now, that says no longer can we say that doing the psychological health and safety stuff is just a bit big and unknown. It's right there now.
So I'm going to wrap up here. As always, we just ask you, and I know it's really difficult given everything we've just talked about, for one solid nugget of advice, if there's one takeaway out of all we've talked about this last hour or so.
And you know, it's exactly what I do to everybody else, but when I'm on the receiving end, it reminds me how challenging that is. I want to just say that, because I've said it already, to be able to just look and realize how much is already there, and that this may feel like an overwhelming, brand new, intangible topic. I certainly don't want to talk myself out of a job here, because I think there's a need for us to come in and give you a hand. But to recognize that most businesses are so much further down the line in terms of potential stuff just sitting there ready to go. And that actually the first thing is to be able to just take stock and stop. And instead of just being completely overwhelmed and go into overdrive, is just to pause, look at all the amazing things that are in place, look at where the gaps are, and recognize there's probably less to do. There's a lot to do, but there's probably less to do than a lot of people think. So I kind of just want to say, yeah, guard against the being overwhelmed. And stay. I speak from experience here. If I feel overwhelmed, my head goes firmly back in the sand. So I'm kind of my own worst enemy. But to say it can sound overwhelming, that framing what we classically talk about as mental health, that's sort of not somebody else's problem, but it's what individuals have their own problems and we can look after them the best we can. But really it's their problems. Reframing mental health, or sorry, the aspect of mental health where workplaces can harm people and don't need to and could do a lot more not to, that reframing can sound really alien and strange and scary. And I actually just think, you know what, especially with a standard like 45003, we've got really good structures now and the right people out there to help. And you're clearly doing a huge amount of work in that space as well. So that wasn't a very good way of narrowing it down to one thing, because it's not my forte. But what I'd say is, heads out of sand, please.
Yeah, perfect. That's great. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you, Jackie. And as always, thank you, Pete, especially for all your work on the standard.
Yes, definitely. Thank you.
Okay.
You've been listening to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention and the new ISO 45003 standard, follow subscribe to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.ukpsychhealthandsafety.com.